This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. 1 year ago today, Hezbollah launched rocket attacks on northern Israel and killed three Israeli soldiers and captured two others in a raid across the Lebanese border. That was the start of a month-long war that has changed both countries. But most of the casualties and most of the destruction were in Lebanon, but Hezbollah forces won by standing up to Israeli attacks. Israeli forces lost their aura of invincibility, and the government of Prime Minister Ehud Olmert continues to pay a political price for its defeat. Later in the program, Murray Horowitz returns as we begin our annual summer movie festival. Today, the best big caper movies. You can send us your nominee to talk@npr.org. But first, if you have questions about the political, military, and strategic consequences of last summer's war between Israel and Hezbollah, about the process of reconstruction and whether the agreements that ended the fighting can be sustained, our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Rami Khoury and Hirsch Goodman join us now. Rami Khoury is editor-at-large for the Lebanese newspaper The Daily Star. He joins us from the BBC studios in Beirut. Hirsch Goodman is a political columnist for the Jerusalem Report. He joins us from NPR's bureau in Jerusalem. And gentlemen, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Hirsch Goodman, let me begin with you. When Prime Minister Olmert began this war, he set out a few things that he hoped to accomplish. One, get his soldiers back. Two, defeat the military forces of Hezbollah. And three, make the Lebanese government forces, the Lebanese army, responsible for security on the southern frontier. Did he accomplish any of those things?
Well, I think he did accomplish the final one, which did get the Lebanese government to deploy its forces. It doesn't matter if they effective or not effective. It's a fact that for the first time they exercised their sovereignty over their own territory. And that was achieved. The other goals weren't achieved. And it's one of the crux of the problems with this war was that the government didn't have clearly defined goals. It didn't really know what it wanted to achieve or not wanted to achieve. And if this war would have ended after 23 minutes, when the Israeli Air Force totally destroyed Hezbollah's long-range and medium-range missiles, and if it would have ended there, it would have been another six-day war-type victory, but unfortunately dragged on, leading to very serious questions about how this war was handled here.
Yeah, the military commander and the defense minister have since lost their jobs, and Prime Minister Olmert is in, he's got a very weak government, I think that's fair to say.
No, actually, the irony is that he has a pretty stable government because everybody wants to stay in power, and nobody really wants an election right now. And the Likud is in sort of disarray, and the Labour Party's just got new leadership, and Kadima, which is Olmert's party, doesn't know really what it is or where, you know, Olmert just took over from Sharon. Nobody elected him. So I think we're in a transitionary stage, and that transitionary stage plays to government stability at this time. But in terms of popularity, in terms of respect, in terms of leadership, in terms of integrity, in terms of maturity, all of those are unfortunately failures of the Prime Minister in the way this war was handled. The Defence Minister had never held a cabinet position. It was irresponsible of Olmert to have made him Defence Minister. And the Chief of Staff was somebody who lived at 60,000 feet and not really cognizant with what it takes in terms of ground forces. But the real failure is at the governmental level.
Rami Khoury, let me turn to you. What did Hezbollah manage to accomplish in this conflict?
The most important thing I think that it accomplished was to show both the willingness and the capacity to fight a 34-day war with Israel and to force Israel and the United States behind it to accept a political ceasefire and a UN-mediated resolution after Israel and the U.S. and Britain and one or two others had explicitly said that they were giving Israel the time and the ammunition and the fuel and the diplomatic cover that it needed to get the job done, as they called it in White House lingo. And, of course, didn't get the job done very well. The Israeli armed forces didn't. And the Hezbollah was able to show that it was able to fight Israel to a draw to some extent in a manner that no other combination of Arab armies had been able to do, and to force Israel into a political ceasefire, which was also what happened in Gaza, by the way. And mm-hmm. Israel was forced into accepting a sort of ceasefire there, and probably a prisoner exchange on both fronts. So I would say that's probably the biggest accomplishment from Hezbollah's point of view.
Hezbollah was described as a state within a state. Is that still true?
Yeah, I mean, that's a vague expression, but I think in the way that most people take it for what it means, yeah. I mean, Hezbollah is a very powerful, very credible and respected organization and has great impact. It is sort of a state within a state. They don't want to be a separate state within a state, nor do they want to take over the Lebanese government, as according to what they say. But they see themselves as having been forced to do this because of the inability of the Lebanese government to assert its sovereignty and its military capabilities to protect Lebanon. And therefore, Hezbollah says that it has been forced to do this to protect Lebanon. And there's a big debate about that, of course, about Hezbollah's true motives. That's one of the issues that's now very much out in the open here.
As you say, Hezbollah won enormous respect for its ability to stand up to Israel for 34 days. Is it now more prominent than it was a year ago?
Yes, I think it is, regionally and in Lebanon. It's also more divisive. You've got a lot of people supporting Hezbollah, but you've got a lot of people also who were either quiet or were sitting on the fence or criticizing it in public, partly because of the consequences of the war, that the destruction that Lebanon suffered and the tension that it suffers today. Many people blame Hezbollah for that. And people criticize it. And, of course, other people criticize it because they see it as part of a regional alliance of groups and countries who are working together to challenge Israel and the United States and some of the Arab leadership. So politically, it scares a lot of people in the Arab world, and militarily, it's a problem for Israel and others. So it's a much more controversial and much more out in the open organization now, especially in Lebanon, because it's reoriented itself to some extent to domestic political contestation. So there's a much greater set of dynamics that are playing around Hezbollah now than there was a couple of years ago.
And Hirsch Goodman, let me ask you about that strategic alignment Rami Kori was just talking about, not just Hezbollah, but its sponsors in Syria and Iran, who are also, of course, involved in helping Hamas in the Gaza Strip.
Yeah, I think there's a much closer alliance between Hezbollah and Iran than there is between Hamas. Hamas is actually very wary of outside forces coming in. They're Sunnis, Iran Shia, Hezbollah Shia, so it's a different kettle of fish. I agree with what Rami was saying in terms of the military consequences of this, but on the other hand, I think that Israel sort of re-established its deterrence. Nasrallah himself said, gee, if I knew what these guys were going to do before this war started, I would never have started this war. So in a way, I think one of the consequences is, yes, Hezbollah did stand up to us and so on and so forth. The other thing is that Israel never really saw Hezbollah as a strategic problem. They saw them as a pain in the backside, a Katyusha here, a kidnapping here. They never saw Hezbollah, even though they knew of the weapons that Hezbollah had, they never thought Hezbollah would attack the heartland of Israel, Haifa, Acre, the Galilee. So in that sense, too, this war came as a big surprise for Israel, I think. Mm.
Let's get some listeners in on the conversation. Our guests have Hirsch Goodman, a senior research associate at the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, and Rami Kori, editor-at-large for the Daily Star. You'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's start with Stefan. Stefan with us from Detroit.
Hi, I don't follow these things as carefully as you guys do, so I don't know where I picked this up. But tell me, do I understand correctly? I was trying to understand how Hezbollah could be characterized as having won the war, given that they were defending themselves, if I understand correctly, you can correct me on this, from between civilian homes. Is that correct or not?
Mm-hmm. Rami Kori.
Well, yes, they are fighting from areas that are full of civilians, and the Israeli army, of course, is full of civilians who are in the army, who are obligated to join the armed forces. So both you had civilians on both sides fighting in various capacities. Hezbollah is not a conventional army. They're a guerrilla force. They see themselves as a resistance movement. And part of their strength, part of the reason they were able to do what they were with Israel, is because they are deeply embedded in the community, and it's very difficult for Israel to root them out, the same way that the U.S. is having problems with the resistance and the insurgents and the terrorists and whatever you want to call them in Iraq. So yeah, you do have this this issue, and this is one of their. They see this as one of their strengths. In fact,
sure. But in the view of the world, don't you think that Hezbollah's moral authority would be compromised because they're pretending that they're fighting it in that fashion, whereas Israel, I assume, could have obliterated the whole of southern Lebanon with their munitions, but they made, I assume, what I would call either a moral or pressed to be a moral choice to not do that.
Mm-hmm. Hirsch Goodman, why don't you try that?
Look, it's a fact that Hezbollah did have placements of its rockets that they were firing against Israel, from hospitals, from schools. It's an old story. From UN positions, close to UN positions, and it makes it very difficult to fight an asymmetric war. It's virtually impossible with all Israel's technology to stop these short-range rockets from coming over the border. There's no technology involved at all, and they place them in the middle of civilian populations. It's a real problem.
The trenches, the defenses,
everything were built in the villages themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to finish the thought. On the other hand, it's okay. I'll finish there.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Stefan. We're talking with Rami Kouri in Beirut and Hirsch Goodman, who's with us from Jerusalem, about the consequences of the war between Hezbollah and Israel 1 year ago. I'm Neil Conan. We'll be back after a short break. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, though, we're talking about last summer's month-long war between Israel and Hezbollah. A year ago, Hezbollah fighters seized two Israeli soldiers in a raid across the Lebanese frontier and killed three others. Israel responded with attacks against roads, bridges, and Hezbollah posts in southern Lebanon and missile sites. The fighting opened rifts in both countries. The consequences are still being felt today. Our guests are Hirsch Goodman, political columnist for the Jerusalem Report, also Rami Kouri, editor-at-large for the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut. If you have questions about the political, military, and strategic consequences of last summer's war, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org, and you can read what other listeners have to say at our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. This is Andy. Andy's with us from Cincinnati.
Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Yes. I wanted to ask how much of a factor is the Israeli incursions into the Sheba Farms area of Lebanon, how much was that a factor into the war, and is there still an issue of the Sheba Farms between Lebanon and Israel, or was it a much larger premise? Was it just simply east versus west?
Or was the Sheba Farms, which is an area that some say belongs to Syria, some say belongs to Lebanon, and which is occupied by Israel, Rami Kouri, was that a factor in this conflict? Is it a continuing factor in the conflict, or is it, as some say, just a fig leaf to cover continued strife?
Right.
Well, it is a factor. I mean, there was really three basic issues were at play here in the conflict between Hezbollah and Israel, or Lebanon as a whole and Israel. One is the Lebanese prisoners that Israel holds. The second one is the Sheba Farm that Israel still occupies and a few other small border areas. And the third one is the cross-border incursions or raids or sending planes that Israel does infringing on Lebanese sovereignty. Those are the three issues that basically are the bilateral issues that Lebanon and Israel have to resolve. And when Hezbollah took those two soldiers and did the cross-border raid, and there was the fight, and more Israelis were killed, and then the two were taken. Hezbollah did it, assuming it, like all other times these things happened, that there would be a reciprocal and proportional response, and they would eventually exchange the prisoners. Of course, that didn't happen. Israel opened up and blasted all of Lebanon, and we had the war for 34 days. But the Shebaa Farms is an issue. These issues are now in Resolution 1701, the UN resolution, and this is important now because there is a political framework which both countries accept that opens the way for a negotiated resolution of the bilateral issues.
And I wanted to throw that same question to you, Hirsch Goodman, in Jerusalem. Is this issue of the Shebaa Farms, is it heading towards resolution?
It's such a non-issue. I just cannot tell you what a non-issue it is. It's one of these things that Hezbollah always picks up on to justify saying, first it was, okay, Israel's got to get out of southern Lebanon. We get out of southern Lebanon, the UN has recognized formally, officially, unequivocally that Israel has retreated to the international border between the two countries. Now, there's this little appendix of territory up in the north that actually belongs to Syria, or Syria claims it is Syria's. And Israel says, okay, we'll resolve this territorial issue when we resolve our other territorial issues with Syria. In the meantime, in the last few days, it's been reported, I think, that the UN force will move in instead of Israel. But it's a real non-issue. The reason this war started was that, and I think in context is a very important thing here. You have to remember at the time, hundreds of rockets were being fired into Israel from Gaza. And what Iran did here was through Hezbollah, through its surrogates, open a northern front against Israel at the same time. The Shebaa Farms is really not the issue.
If I can just jump in here.
Go ahead, Rami Kouri.
I agree at some level with Hirsch, but at the same point, I think reciprocally, the land itself, the Shebaa Farms is a small area. It's not that big a deal. I agree in itself, but the point is Israel does exactly the same thing. I mean, Israel got hung up on a few hundred meters of land on the border of the Sea of Lake of Galilee when they were negotiating a peace with Syria. So small pieces of land that are insignificant in their own take on tremendously important symbolic significance in other ways. So we shouldn't understand that these sort of small pieces of land are surrogates for larger issues.
Thanks very much for the call, Andy.
Great, thank you.
Okay, you mentioned the United Nations. The fighting was ended by a United Nations resolution, and there are UN forces now in the area. Yet, are they being effective? Is this seen as a permanent or even a long-term solution, Rami Kouri?
No, not permanent or long-term. It's an interim solution. It's supposed to kind of separate the two sides, provide a buffer. It's significant that the international UN force was expanded. It's around 12,000 now. It's significant that the Lebanese army moved down into the south. Both of these were done with Hezbollah approval because Hezbollah was in the government then. So the presence of this large force is significant. It reduces the likelihood of a big clash taking place. It doesn't eliminate it, but it reduces the likelihood of Israel and Hezbollah squaring off again on the border. But it just gives you a little bit of breathing space, really, is all it does. And it's important that the resolution 1701 is the framework that is there if both sides decide they want to resolve the issues. The problem is it's not just a local Lebanese-Israeli issue. You have Syria, you have Iran, you have the U.S., the Saudis, the Americans. There's many factors here that are involved, and what's happening in Lebanon reflects wider regional and global tensions.
And Hirsch Goodman.
I would just say, if I may, that when a UN force is wanted by both parties, it succeeds. At the moment, both parties want this force there, and it's succeeding. It's the same with the UN force that oversees the relations between Israel and Syria. It's the same between the UN forces down in Egypt. Where both sides want them, they will work. Both sides did not want UNIFIL, the previous force, and therefore it didn't work. So I think the UN is working here in a much more stable environment than before.
Yet one of the things that UN force is, from Israel's point of view, hopefully doing is preventing the rearmament of Hezbollah from across the border in Syria. Is that working?
I really don't know what to tell you responsibly. There are reports here every day of convoys from Syria going over with weapons over to Hezbollah, and of Hezbollah rebuilding and retrenching and so on and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that Rami's right. With 12,000 blue berets out there, there's a very effective buffer between a ground clash of Hezbollah and Israel. And the presence of this buffer is broad enough to make their short-range missiles ineffective. So it's working. And until we can come to a broader resolution of the problem, this is a good interim solution.
Let's get Robert on the line. Robert's calling us from Chicago.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to compare and contrast the news coverage of two very similar types of conflict. One is the media coverage of Israel's fighting in Lebanon, where the battlefield was not only littered by civilians, but also by news reporters and cameramen. And contrast that with the news coverage of the Lebanese army fighting against the Palestinian camp in Tripoli, where essentially the news was barred from the scene. There was no accurate reporting of the civilian casualties there. And the Lebanese army was free to shell into civilian areas without any comment or criticism by any media. So I think that points out the modus operandi by which Hezbollah is able to get away with what they do, because the media is essentially aiding them, perhaps inadvertently, but aiding them in their goals.
Well, Rami Khoury, among other things, Hezbollah provides its own media.
Yeah, but I'm not sure what Robert was talking about. The battle in the north in Lebanon is between the Lebanese army and a small group of radical militant terrorists, Fatah al-Islam, while the war between Israel and Hezbollah was covered intensively and extensively by media, international media and local media on both sides. So I'm not sure if he's saying Hezbollah has something to do with the fighting in the north? Because if he does, he's badly mistaken. I'm not sure if that's what he meant.
Robert?
That is not what I meant. What I meant to say is that the media is treating these two situations with a double standard. It's the media's double standard which provides more criticism of Israel and apparently no criticism of the Lebanese army.
When it shells opponents in areas...
Not opponents. They're shelling civilians.
Well, they're shelling opponents who are in amongst civilians. We accept that there are
it's
civilians
the
in the
situation.
Camp.
The same situation is occurring in Lebanon right now.
Mm-hmm.
I would suggest that Robert maybe get some more accurate information on what's happening in the north. I think his basic point is a fair one about we shouldn't have double standards, and that's something that I've been saying for years, and I'm sure Hirsch says the same thing. We want a single standard of law, morality, and media coverage, of course. The situations are very different in the north, in Lebanon, and what happened between Hezbollah and Israel. You have had quite a bit of... you've had Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Lebanese groups, many people pointing out the problem with the civilian suffering in the north. So I don't think it hasn't been blacked out or anything. It's a very, very difficult situation. So I think... it's not quite as bad as he's saying.
Now, I would say professionally, this is something I study at the Institute of National Security Studies. Today, where every camera is actually, where every telephone is actually a television camera, and you can get any message out instantaneously to any network that operates 24 hours a day, the whole coverage of conflict has changed tremendously. A person with a camera, if he gets on air, can put over a message that is totally, totally distorted from what I watched the beginnings of this war in Australia, of all places, and I was convinced that all of Beirut had been smashed into the ground because of what I was seeing, of the images that I was seeing on television, when in fact what we bombed was a very small percentage of Beirut. Rami, correct me if I'm wrong, that was Hezbollah controlled. So this whole issue of media and how it covers conflicts, and especially conflicts that are asymmetric in urban areas, is a very, very interesting one. And it's not necessarily born out of bias.
Thanks very much. Let's see if we could get Sam. Sam is on the line with us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Yes, hello. Rami, I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
And I have a question for you.
You bet.
I believe that the Syrians were the winners in the war against between Hezbollah and Israel. And what can the Lebanese government do to regain the lost? Do we have to wait another 30 years to restart?
Well, the Syrian role in Lebanon is one of the big issues now in the political tensions and contestations taking place inside Lebanon, as is Iran's role, because Syria and Iran are very close to Hezbollah. They help it, they supply it, they're very close strategic allies in many ways. And there's a huge a problem with the Lebanese-Syrian relationship. Many people, I would say about half the country in Lebanon, is critical of Syria, and the other half is less critical, and this is reflected in the battle over the Lebanese government. I think the Syrian-Lebanese relationship is one of the critical issues that has to be resolved before you can expect to have any kind of long-term stability in Lebanon, as is the Iranian situation, as is Israel's relationship. All of these are issues that have to be resolved. So I think Lebanon is in for a bumpy ride for some time until these regional tensions are resolved. The quickest way to move in that direction, I would think, would be to resume an Arab-Israeli comprehensive peace negotiation, which would take the wind out of the sail of many of these tensions.
Thanks for the call. We're talking with Rami Khoury of the Daily Star in Beirut and with Hirsch Goodman, political columnist for the Jerusalem Report. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Rami Khoury, after the conflict ended, there were all kinds of pledges of support from many nations around the world, particularly in the Middle East, for reconstruction aid for Lebanon. Hezbollah wanted to do a lot of the reconstruction itself. The United States was providing funds. How has that gone?
Well, it's going reasonably well in most cases. You've had a lot of things that have been fixed and rebuilt, and bridges and roads, etc., that were destroyed, some schools, housing. There's some major repair work that's been done to the infrastructure that was destroyed, and a lot of the housing has been repaired. Some of it is being rebuilt. But there's still a lot to be done. You've had Qataris, United Arab Emirates, all these others have contributed money, and many expatriate Lebanese. But you still have many, many people, tens of thousands, who are not living in their original homes because they have to be rebuilt, and they haven't been rebuilt yet. And there's some complaints by Lebanese, both they criticize the government, some criticize Hezbollah, about the slowness of slow pace of some of the reconstruction. But the problem isn't just the physical reconstruction, it's the reconstruction, rebuilding of confidence in the country and the economy. And the problem in Lebanon today is the immobilized, dysfunctional political system. And this is really what's the major problem in Lebanon now.
And Hirsch Goodman, considerably less destruction caused by Hezbollah rockets in northern Israel. Yet that psychological point that Rami was talking about, how has that changed?
No, I think generally speaking, there has been a commission of inquiry here that's looked into the shortcomings of the war. Some of the horror stories about the shortcomings of equipment and so on and so forth, people feel on the mend. Generally speaking, the price Israel paid in this war, I have to say, I was up north very shortly after the war, and every life is a important life, but 36 people killed in this war, 18 Israeli Jews and 18 Israeli Arabs, was not an unacceptable number, if you could put it that way. The real issue with this war was that it caught Israel at a very interesting time, when its military had made a decision that there are two threats, terror and Iran, and Hezbollah was discounted, and a ground war with Syria or Jordan or Iraq or Egypt, all those were not going to happen anymore, so they didn't invest in their ground forces. They've now rethought that. So generally speaking, I feel that this war was a shock for everyone. It went out of control. Unfortunately, inexperienced government and ministers handled it here. But in the country, generally, the end game with the UN in place and the Lebanese army down there is seen as a plus.
Rami Khoury, do Lebanese feel, and we just, I'm afraid, have a few seconds left, but do Lebanese feel that they came out with a plus at the end of this conflict?
Lebanese who support Hezbollah feel pretty good about themselves, but they also understand the consequences in political terms of this war and the internal tensions that are gripping the country now, the economic stress, the decline in the economy and tourism and foreign investment. People are feeling the negative consequences very much, and they also feel, many Lebanese feel, that their future is very vulnerable until these big sticker political items are are resolved. But at the same time, many people feel there's a sense of pride among many Lebanese, not all Lebanese, but many Lebanese, that Hezbollah was able to do this to force Israel to withdraw and to a ceasefire. I think people realize that war is not the answer, and you have to resolve these issues politically in a way that's fair to both sides.
Rami Khoury, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Rami Khoury, editor-at-large for the Lebanese newspaper, The Daily Star, with us from BBC Studios in Beirut. Hirsch Goodman, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Hirsch Goodman, political columnist for the Jerusalem Report, with us from NPR's Bureau in Jerusalem. The Summer Movie Festival, when we return, it's Talk of the Nation.